Coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In Iraq, three deadly bombings struck parts of Baghdad Wednesday, killing at least 93, wounding more than 150. The deadliest attack occurred at a marketplace in the Shia Sadr City neighborhood, killing 64. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for Wednesday's attacks. U.S. Army Major General Gary Valesky, briefing reporters from Baghdad, said he believes Iraqi security forces are capable of dealing with the threat posed by IS.
As the enemy loses more and more terrain, they resort to some of these desperate acts. The security forces in Baghdad have the situation under control, but our condolences go out to those families.
Valesky said Iraqi forces are making great progress in reclaiming land lost to insurgents. In Washington Wednesday, the U.S. spokesperson Elizabeth Trudeau condemned the bombings.
These cowardly attacks only harden the resolve of Iraqis and the international community to utterly destroy this group and its warped ideology.
She said the U.S. remains committed to helping Iraq remove the IS threat from its territory and suffocate its financial, foreign terrorist fighter and propaganda networks. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his forces have killed 3,000 IS militants in Syria and Iraq. Speaking Wednesday to military officials in the Balkans, he denied any sympathy for the IS state, insisting no country can match the efforts against the IS group conducted by Turkey. A Somali commando unit has killed at least 15 suspected Islamist fighters in a raid on a al-Shabaab base in the Galgaduud region of central Somalia, the second such raid in 2 days. A local government official told VOA the aim of the raid to destroy the base and neutralize the militants' capacity to organize and carry out attacks. Wednesday's raid, a day after a raid on an al-Shabaab base in the village of Toro. This is VOA News. There are reports Islamic State fighters having pulled out of the ancient Syrian city Palmyra following a government offensive in March are once again on the march. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said IS fighters have cut a key road linking Palmyra with the provincial capital, Homs. The IS group last week seized a gas field in Homs province. White House spokesman Josh Earnest was asked Wednesday if the U.S. is prepared to coordinate with Russia militarily in Syria.
We have talked for quite some time about the efforts that are currently underway to deconflict our military activities with Russia in the skies over Iraq and in Syria. And you know, there have been a number of consultations about that. But those consultations have stopped short of any sort of formal military cooperation. And I don't anticipate that that will change.
Meanwhile, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said an airstrike on IS-held territory in Deir ez-Zor province Wednesday killed at least seven civilians. And a two-day ceasefire expired midnight local time in the embattled city Aleppo, with reports of a rocket attack that killed at least two. Brazil's Senate has been debating and continues to do so whether to proceed with an impeachment trial against President Dilma Rousseff. The debate came as the country's Supreme Court rejected her bid to halt the proceedings. It appears the votes are there for a trial. If a majority of lawmakers so vote, she'll be suspended from office during legal proceedings. Vice President Michel Temer will temporarily take power. Kenya is drawing up a timetable to close the Dadaab refugee camp that cares for hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees over security concerns and despite international pressure to keep it open. Josephine Karisi is the country's interior minister.
Kenya is committed to closing the Dadaab refugee complex. This decision has been made by government reflecting the fact that the camps have become hosting ground for al-Shabaab, as well as centers of smuggling and contraband trade, besides being enablers of illicit weapon proliferation.
The East African country has suffered repeated terrorist attacks, most carried out by the Somali-based insurgent group al-Shabaab. Officials have said many of those attacks have been launched from the Dadaab camp. Ugandan police arrested opposition leader Kizza Besigye just hours before President Yoweri Museveni was to be sworn in for a fifth term. The 71-year-old Museveni has been in power since 1986. He received 60% of the vote in February's election. Besigye got 35%, rejecting the results, citing alleged rigging and other irregularities. In Tunisia, at least four security force members were killed Wednesday when a suspected Islamist militant detonated a suicide bombing belt during a raid in the southern town of Tatooine, an operation designed to prevent new militant attacks in the capital. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A detained Ugandan opposition leader's wife demands his immediate release.
What I know is that Kizza Besigye has committed no crime. It was not a crime that he stood in the election. It was not a crime that he won that election. And it's not a crime that he should go among his supporters and be free in the city like any other citizen.
Winnie Yeman is the wife of jailed Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. Zambia's Electoral Commission banned the use of cell phones during the country's August 2016 election. Youth gangs terrorized some neighborhoods in Abidjan. And Democratic Republic of Congo's government welcomes a court ruling that says President Kabila can remain in office if the country fails to hold election this year.
What the court ruled is exactly the Article 17 of the Constitution, the DRC Constitution. There is nothing new at all.
Lamba Mende is the Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mining deals in the DRC come under scrutiny, and we'll speak with one of the lawyers in the child support case of Liberian Senator George Weah. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The wife of former Ugandan opposition presidential candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, is calling for his immediate and unconditional release from police detention. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change was arrested again Wednesday by Ugandan police after making a surprised appearance in Kampala City, causing a stampede by his supporters who wanted to see him. He had been under police surveillance at his house since the February 18 presidential election. The arrest came as President Yoweri Museveni is being sworn in today, Thursday. Besigye's wife, Winnie Bianyima, says she is concerned about her husband's health and the lack of information about his whereabouts.
He has been arrested, and I'm extremely concerned because I cannot confirm where he is being held. I'm demanding to know where he is being held so that family can check on him and his lawyer can see him.
Was there any information given as to why he was arrested?
Absolutely none. And that's why I'm also demanding for his immediate release, because he has committed no crime. He just beat the security that has been holding him in illegal detention at our home, and went into the city and received a very warm, enthusiastic welcome by his supporters. And they grabbed him, and we have not a clue where he's being held. And I'm concerned about his health because he's been suffering some chest infection since they injected tear gas and pepper spray into the car that he was in a couple of weeks ago when he was arrested in Ntungamo. He hasn't been well. I'm now concerned that he's disappeared.
As you know, President Museveni is being sworn in today, Thursday. And as you spoke with us the other day, yesterday, that the FDC had announced that it was also going to do its own inauguration. Do you know if that inauguration took place and that your husband was sworn in as the president of Uganda?
I heard that, and I saw some video of it on social media, but I don't know enough about it. What I know is that Kizza Besigye has committed no crime. It was not a crime that he stood in the election. It was not a crime that he won that election. And it's not a crime that he should go among his supporters and be free in the city like any other citizen.
The police are saying that by Dr. Besigye doing what he's doing, by coming through the city, he is violating the Constitutional Court's order, which said that he or his agents cannot organize any procession or carry on with his defiance campaign.
It's absolute rubbish. Total nonsense. He's a Ugandan, enjoys the same rights as every other Ugandan to move freely in the country, to go wherever he wants, to meet people, to even call a meeting.
As I said again, President Museveni is being sworn in today, Thursday. Do you have any message for the people of Uganda?
My message to President Museveni is to step back and reflect. He may go to his coronation, but this will not take away the fact that this was a discredited election and that Ugandans are rejecting the result, and that he needs to step back and find a resolution to this challenge that the country faces. I also ask the government to free the media, to remove the blockage on social media. After all, for many, many people.
Munibia Yeman is the wife of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. She was speaking with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali, where she is attending the World Economic Forum on Africa. The Electoral Commission of Zambia has issued a new directive banning the use of cell phones inside polling stations during the August 11 presidential, legislative and local elections. But some opposition groups have questioned the rationale behind the directive. Priscilla Isaac, Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the directive to ban the use of cell phones is to ensure the transparency and credibility of the electoral process.
Well, what it is, Peter, is that they will not be allowed to use cell phones inside the polling station. But if somebody needs to make a call or send a message, they can do so outside the polling station building. Because we found that this tends to be disruptive. Last year in January, we actually had some voters taking photos of their ballot paper after they had marked it, and they were posting it on social media, which is not permissible because that is the equivalent of campaigning. It compromises the secrecy of the ballot.
So it is illegal for people to take pictures of the vote they have already marked for one candidate or the other?
Yes, because if you're going to expose it, that's another form of campaigning. Once you put it, you post it on social media, you're now showing people who you voted for. And it can be taken as a form of campaigning.
Some opposition groups have been highly critical of that move, and they said it is not fair, and some are saying that they were not contacted or consulted before this directive, and that this was meant to help one party or the other. What do you say to that?
No, that's not true. It's just to ensure that we maintain order within the polling stations and not have the secrecy of the vote compromised. And we don't want disturbances within the polling stations. Can you imagine you're in a polling station, people are voting, and everybody is on the phone, talking on the phone, and tweeting and what have you. It will just become disruptive and cause discomfort to the voters.
So how is the Electoral Commission going to enforce this ban?
People have to obey. Once the Electoral Commission gives a directive of how procedures are within the polling station, then people have to comply. And it's not unique to Zambia. In the Seychelles, you're not even allowed to enter a polling station with your phone. You have to surrender your phone. And what it is we are saying, if you want to make a call, send a message, go outside and do it from the outside. The same political parties will be the ones complaining if the marked ballot papers that are being circulated in social media are not in their favor. They'll be the same ones complaining, saying that they're being disadvantaged. The same can be said about marked ballot papers being posted on social media during the course of voting on election day.
Concerns have been raised about ongoing clashes between UPND and PF CADES. What is the Electoral Commission doing about this?
The onus is upon the political parties to be responsible for the behavior of their supporters and their behaviors as political parties. As a commission, we can't force them not to be violent, but they know the consequences of violence. So it's up to them to be responsible and to refrain from violence and from provoking each other.
Priscilla Isaac is Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 12th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon, and Radio Hot Cocoa, also in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is welcoming a constitutional court ruling that President Joseph Kabila should remain in office if the country fails to hold presidential elections come November this year. Mr. Kabila, elected since 2001, is required by the constitution to step down this year. The opposition has accused him of purposely blocking elections so that he may stay in power. But Information Minister Lambert Mende says the court ruling is in line with the DRC constitution.
What the Constitutional Court ruled today is exactly what is written in the Constitution, in the provision of the Constitution. But you see, people have launched a lot of controversy about the presidency after the end of this year, saying that if the Electoral Commission is not able to organize the election, then we should have another president to organize the election. That is why a group of MPs went to the court to ask an interpretation. Another group went to confirm the controversial idea that we should have another president at the end of this year if the elections are not organized. So what the court ruled is exactly the Article 70 of the Constitution, the DRC Constitution. There is nothing new at all.
So what do you say, Mr. Minister, to those who say that this is an attempt by President Kabila not to hold elections?
President Kabila launched yesterday, or I think the day before yesterday, the enrolling campaign that is going on now all over the country. The Electoral Commission is busy enrolling electors. So I don't know of which country you are speaking. We are preparing for elections, but there will be some delay. This is not the end of the world. We must organize free, fair, and credible elections. Meantime, we must make sure that the state is run normally.
What do you say to the opposition people who say that this is the wrong interpretation of Article 70? That is, it can only apply after an election has been held and there's a gap before the next president is inaugurated.
Wrong interpretation of the Constitution by the Constitutional Court, my dear. This is something I have never heard. Those are people who are the only entitled to give interpretation of the Constitution. So when they give interpretation, that is all. There is nobody else to say that it is wrong or not. So this is the way state of rule is organized, even in your country.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister for the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The United Kingdom is hosting an international anti-corruption summit beginning today, Thursday, and researchers at Global Witness hope leaders there will address the use of overseas British territories in suspicious Democratic Republic of Congo mining deals. Pete Jones, a campaigner with Global Witness, talks to Ricky Shryak about how these deals sometimes spike during election cycles as the money is used to finance elections.
A lot of the time there's this conception that corruption is something that happens in places like Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's a problem for the Congolese, and it's their administrations that are corrupt and they need to sort out their own house. And what we're saying is you can't strike these kinds of deals without the financial structures that facilitate them to be in place. So you need lawyers and you need registering agents and you need jurisdictions that allow you to incorporate companies secretly without while hiding the beneficial owners. And whilst the British overseas territories aren't the only secrecy jurisdictions in the world, they have been used in every single one of the deals that we've looked at here with Congo. And with the UK hosting this summit, we feel it's a great opportunity for David Cameron to be seen to be taking a lead. And what we're suggesting is that the UK government compels its overseas territories and its crown dependencies, which are secrecy jurisdictions, to maintain public registers of beneficial ownership. So that would mean that every time a company is incorporated inside their jurisdiction, there has to be a list, a publicly available list, of who the real human beings are behind those companies.
According to Global Witness, resources in DRC were exploited during the last election cycle in 2011, when your researchers say a series of suspicious mining deals were struck that cost Congo more than $1 billion US dollars. So with this new election coming up in November, is Global Witness seeing an increase in suspicious mining deals again?
We looked at five mining deals in particular that were struck around 2011, which all had quite similar characteristics in the sense that the deals were unannounced, they were quite secretive, contracts weren't published, and they involved offshore companies that hid the owners. And in each case, it was companies incorporated in the British Virgin Islands. And around the time of the 2011 elections, there were reports in the media and accusations from the opposition that some of the proceeds from one of these deals in particular was used or was instructed to be sent to an account which was for the election campaign. So there's obviously a major concern that these sorts of suspicious deals that we've seen before are being used for sort of off-the-books election financing. We realise that, you know, this is a very fraught year politically in Congo. There's meant to be an election in November. And what we have seen is a sort of spike in new deals being signed in Congo's copper industry, in particular the industrial copper sector.
That was Pete Jones, a campaigner with Global Witness, speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. The Ivory Coast government is trying to reach out to gangs of youths who are terrorizing parts of the commercial capital, Abidjan, as fed-up residents have started taking matters into their own hands. Emily Yop has more from Abidjan.
The mere mention of the so-called microbe stirs fear and anger. They are very dangerous elements, says one woman. A few days ago, they attacked an internet cafe right there at the intersection. It's dangerous to go out late, she says. By 10 or 11 p.m., they are everywhere. Microbe is the French term for germs. But here in Abidjan, it refers to gangs of young men and boys, some only 10 years old, wreaking havoc on the streets. The gangs have been tied to numerous assaults, robberies, and even murders. The gangs started in a crowded, low-income part of Abidjan called Abobo. One resident says, we catch a kid and take him to the police, and 2 days later, we see him out in the street again. There is no follow-up, no justice, he says. So next time, we won't take him to authorities, he will be lynched, and that's all. In April, an angry mob killed a 19-year-old Microbe chief in the street in broad daylight, which in return triggered revenge attacks. In some areas, residents have set up self-defense groups. Issa leads one of the groups. He says they were assaulting our parents, our mothers. They were very violent. He says police had only one car patrolling the neighborhood and couldn't protect us. He says it was like we were in a cage and had lions attacking us. We had to defend ourselves. Armed with machetes and sticks, the residents' group would patrol the streets at night and confront the gangs. Local businesses paid the vigilantes protection money, but the violence only continued, and lately, Issa said they have switched their approach. He says, we told ourselves we should try to establish trust between us and these kids, try to listen to them and understand what brings them to do these things. The government is now trying outreach. Leontine Zagba runs the program to protect vulnerable children at the Ministry of Women, Family and Child Protection. She says, when you have no self-esteem, you have nothing to lose and will do anything. She says they are working with them to bring their self-esteem back and show them that not all is lost. Last year, a test project sent about 70 teenagers to a rehabilitation center to learn skills like mechanics, woodwork and sewing. But former Microbe faced stigma when they tried to get work, says Atigi Kone, president of the NGO Fedosi, based in Abobo. He says the government should think about creating jobs and industry here, since people are scared of people from Abobo. It's one of the solutions worth exploring, he says. No one knows exactly how many Microbe there are. The best estimates are several hundred, but Kone says Ivory Coast cannot afford to underestimate the trouble they could cause. Emily Yap from UN News in Abidjan.
A hearing was held yesterday in the U.S. state of Georgia in the child support case involving Ambassador George Weah of Liberia's main opposition party, the Congress for Democratic Change. The petition was filed by Ms. Miapet Gono, the mother of Weah's 10-year-old daughter. John Strauss is one of Weah's lawyers. He says the court dismissed the petition.
The court had previously dismissed a warrant that was wrongfully issued against Mr. Weah, and the attorney for the mother of Mr. Weah's child wanted the court to reconsider whether that warrant should have been dismissed. And when we went to court today, and the court was once again shown the unequivocal proof that Mr. Weah has been supporting his daughter, the court said that it was clear that he was supporting his daughter, that no warrant should have ever been issued in the first place. So the court declined to take any action and indicated that the warrant would remain dismissed. I would point out, too, that and this was pointed out to the court, Mr. Guia never received notice of the hearing at which time a warrant was issued in the first place. And because he had not received notice, he wasn't there or no one was there on his behalf in order to be able to provide the proof that established that he had been supporting his daughter. And so the only time that a warrant was ever issued was when attempts were taken by the attorney for the mother of Mr. Wea's daughter to have a hearing set without any notice to Mr. Wea.
Counselor, I mean, this thing about a warrant notice and a hearing has to do with Ambassador Wea, whether he's paying child support to his 10-year-old daughter in the United States here. From your knowledge, has Mr. Wea been paying child support for this girl?
He's been paying child support not pursuant to a court order, but he has been paying support for this child and continues to pay support for this child.
So what do you think is responsible for this consistent warrant, particularly involving the woman by whom that Ambassador Wea had this child? What is responsible for that if he has been paying child support?
The only answer that I could provide would be greed. But quite frankly, I'm not involved in reading the minds of why this is being done. All I can say is it's wrong.
John Strauss is one of the lawyers in the child support case involving George Wea of Liberia. You are speaking with me from the U.S. state of Georgia. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Woman in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Tunisian defending champions Esperance outwitted Gabon's Stade Manji 32-19 in the men's quarterfinals at the Africa Handball Cup Winners' Cup Championship in Laayoune, Morocco on Wednesday. Egypt's Zamalek dismissed Morocco's Cayman 35-22. Tunisia's Hammamet outplayed Cameroon's FAP 32-20. And Egypt's Heliopolis pipped Morocco's Wydad Smara 23-21. Meanwhile, the women's defending champions Primeiro de Agosto of Angola dismissed Morocco's Mikisi 37-17. Cameroon's FAP beat Ivory Coast's Africa Sports 28-22 as Cameroon's Tonnerre Yaounde outclassed Morocco's Ascoum 31-13 and Angola's Progresso pipped the Republic of Congo's ASEL 24-22. Turning to football, the format for the contest in the Orange Africa Champions League and the Orange Africa Confederations Cup will change from next year. The Confederation of African Football President Issa Hayatou disclosed in the Mexican capital, Mexico City, on Wednesday. Addressing the CAF General Assembly, Hayatou disclosed that the top 16 teams in each of the competitions will be divided into groups of four instead of the current eight divided into two groups. In Japan, a Ghana Black Stars team composed of home-based players went down 3-0 to Japan's Olympic team in a friendly match played in Saga on Wednesday. Finally, Ethiopia's Defense Force team coach Gebremedin Haile takes charge as interim coach of the Ethiopia national team, the Ethiopia Football Federation disclosed in the capital Addis Ababa. According to the federation, he's in charge for the remaining 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. His first order of business is to put together a winning combination to face Lesotho next month. Haile takes over from Yonez Salim, who was dismissed a fortnight ago. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, May 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Zubair Etayeb, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Thursday.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News.
features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.